Well, as I said, then Psalm 61 is our text this evening. And Psalm 60, we saw last week, has a standout section, verses 6 to 8. We, in a very particular way, focused on those verses. And Psalm 61 also has a standout section. In this case, it's one line, that line in verse 5 about the heritage. That is this psalm's focal point. What's a heritage? Well, a heritage is similar to an inheritance. The words are obviously similar, and the meanings are also similar. Perhaps, however, it's fair to say that while inheritance usually refers to concrete, quantifiable realities that one takes possession of, heritage usually refers to slightly more intangible realities that one takes possession of. And I think that distinction will be borne out as we explore this evening this heritage in Psalm 61. And there are two things in particular that I want us to notice. And without further ado then, let's get on with the first. I want us to notice there's a person here who anticipates the heritage with urgency. There's a person here who anticipates the heritage with urgency. There is clearly a particular person in view there in verse 5. You have given me the heritage, is what the verse says. Now, you could read this psalm and think something along these lines. Okay, we have in the first part, verses 1 to 5, some random person in a difficult situation needing help. That's what we have there. But then, having expressed his predicament and brought it before God, this random person in the second part of the psalm inexplicably forgets his difficulties, changes tack altogether, and prays to God for the king. So you could read the psalm in that way, but I don't think that would be a correct reading of it. It's much more unified than that. A key line is that one at the end of verse 7. Speaking of the king, appoint steadfast love and faithfulness to watch over him. To watch over him. Now that strongly suggests that the king is in a difficult situation needing help. He needs watching over. He needs protection of some kind. So in the first part of the psalm we have a random person in a difficult situation needing help. And then in the second part of the psalm, we have the king in a difficult situation needing help. At which point I think the penny should drop. Ah, maybe there is no random person here after all. Maybe the person in a difficult situation needing help is the king all along. Only in the first part of the psalm, he speaks of himself in the first person, my, me, I. Whereas in the second part of the psalm, he speaks of himself in the third person, his, he, him. So I hope you're with me so far. I'm saying the king is the one who is speaking throughout Psalm 61. But let me just push that a bit further still. When Fraser was little, it would be someone's birthday in the family, and so that he didn't feel left out, being the youngest in the family, he would be in on the whole present-giving thing. And so he'd be entrusted with one of the presents then to take it through to Isaac or Hannah or whoever was having the birthday and give the thing. But Fraser was a straightforward little fellow. He wasn't into all this silly beating around the bush, you know, the recipient kind of drawing out the whole unwrapping process, making lots of incorrect guesses as to what the present might be. He didn't have time for that. He liked to cut to the chase. And so he would hand over the wrapped up present. And as he did so, he would tell the recipient exactly what the present was. It's a bar of chocolate, he would say. It's a pencil case or whatever it might be. The rest of the family would try to cough loudly at that point to prevent the recipient hearing the disclosure. But that's what Fraser would do. And I'm going to do the sermonic equivalent of that this evening. I guess the textbook way to approach this psalm would go something like this. So the king who's speaking throughout the psalm is David, this difficult situation in which he needs help is probably when Absalom, his son, had usurped the throne of Israel. So let's spend 25 minutes of the sermon thinking about that. And then at the end, we'll recognize that in a truer and deeper sense, the king is David's descendant. It's Jesus, and we'll throw out a few hurried remarks about him. Well, I can't be bothered really with that approach this evening. I'm going to do a Fraser. I'm going to cut to the chase and tell you at the outset, the king is Jesus. Yes, there's a bit of wrapping paper perhaps, a bit of King David around the edges here, but the king is Jesus. I mean, when we read, as we do in verses 6 and 7 there, of a king enduring to all generations, of a king being enthroned forever, if that doesn't get our messianic antennae buzzing, then nothing probably will. We sang that kind of language just now, didn't we? In Psalm 72, we sang of a king, let him live forever. May his name endure forever. Long may he live. And in Psalm 72, as I mentioned before we sang it, we're in no doubt, are we, that we're singing of King Jesus. It's uncontroversial. It's just taken for granted when it comes to Psalm 72. There's that other line, isn't there, alongside the ones I've just mentioned there, all nations will be blessed in him. Well, that can't possibly be anybody but Jesus. But just because that particular line isn't here in Psalm 61, that doesn't mean that we have to be all cautious in this case and more reserved about seeing Jesus. Clearly, the same king is being spoken of in both Psalms. You don't have to be a literary genius to work that out. We know it's King Jesus in Psalm 72. I'm saying let's be unapologetic that it's King Jesus in Psalm 61 also. Now, remember we said then that the king in this passage, in this psalm rather, is in a difficult situation needing help. And now we're saying the king is Jesus. What's going on then? Well, I would put it to you, it's Jesus in his passion that we're confronting in Psalm 61. It's his sufferings, that fateful weekend in Jerusalem, that call forth the moving words of verse 2 here, my heart is faint. And indeed the other phrase there in verse 2, from the end of the earth, I call to you. The end of the earth in this context doesn't have any geographical connotations. It's just a place that feels utterly beyond the pale. That's what the end of the earth means here. It suggests a God-forsaken wasteland, a barren, grotesque, grimly inhospitable location. And is that not how Golgotha must have seemed to Jesus? With its rotting human remains scattered about, with its callous soldiers gambling for any available spoils, with its depraved spectators gratifying their perverse appetites for the cocktail of nudity and violence which crucifixion offered up. It was an environment stripped of all normal decency and decorum, devoid of respect, devoid of dignity. Its whole atmosphere as close to that of hell as you could ever get here on earth. Truly, Jesus must have felt that he was at the end of the earth. That Friday, in that place. And so, I'm saying then, Jesus is at Golgotha in Psalm 61. And from there then, he looks forward to a better future. He anticipates the heritage that lies ahead of him, the other side of all this suffering. And the heritage which he anticipates beyond the cross, it comprises several components. Let's have a quick look at them. First of all, safety. Safety. This is verses 2 and 3. That's something that emphatically he doesn't have at Golgotha. At Golgotha, it's open season on Jesus. Everyone is putting the boot in. He's defenseless. This past week, Isaac and Talitha were on Duke of Edinburgh expeditions, one in Yorkshire, the other in the Lake District. And the weather in both places was very hot, and they were walking on high, bare slopes. And the first thing then that both of them talked about when I picked them up was the exposedness of the terrain, nowhere at all to take shelter from the sun. Jesus at Golgotha has nowhere at all to take shelter from the intensity of hatred and hostility being directed at him. But you see, on the other side of Golgotha, that will change. He's going to enter God's presence. And as we'll see, that means various things, but at the most basic level, God will be, as it were, a huge rock for him, in whose shade Jesus will finally relax, safe at last. As he anticipates this aspect of the heritage, he speaks specifically, doesn't he, and beautifully indeed, of the rock that is higher than I. That's what Isaac and Talitha needed. A rock that's half the size of you, that's no good, is it, when you're exposed to the bright, searing sunlight. However much you crouch down behind a little rock, some part of you is going to still remain exposed. Well, Jesus had stones. He had mini boulders at Golgotha that provided some partial, patchy shade. They were friends at the foot of the cross. There were eventually those heartening words of one of the criminals on the other crosses. But there was no rock higher than he that could really offer meaningful help at Golgotha. But soon he would have that. Soon he would run through heaven's gates and flop down in the shadow of the great divine rock himself. Never again to be threatened. Never again to be endangered. Safety, I'm saying, is one component of this heritage which Jesus is anticipating. Secondly, intimacy. Intimacy, verse 4. The shade of a rock is a nice image, but it's a limited one. I mean, a rock is just so impassive and inanimate, isn't it? A mother bird, on the other hand, that's different. Its outstretched wings aren't just there, a fixed, static thing for the chicks to nestle under. No, the mother bird actively, intentionally stretches out the wings, wanting and encouraging the chicks to nestle under them. There's a bond between the mother bird and the chicks that there simply isn't between a rock and someone who shelters behind a rock. And in verse 4 then, the mother bird picture takes over from the rock one, to capture what it will be like when beyond his suffering, Jesus enters the presence of God. He won't simply flop down beside a protecting but unfeeling, emotionless, relationally clueless God. No, God will pull Jesus close to him. He'll embrace him. He'll receive him to his bosom in the most warmly possessive and intimate manner. So the heritage, it involves safety, it involves intimacy. Thirdly, it involves majesty, verses 6 and 7. This takes us a step further still. Jesus, post-Golgotha, is going to enter the presence of God, not just to receive asylum following a grueling ordeal, but also to receive majesty, to be enthroned, verse 7 says. We know all about enthronement, don't we? Millions of us watched the one that took place on the 6th of May. And it seemed very grand and splendid, didn't it? But notice that all its grandeur and splendor is utterly blown away by one little phrase in verse 7 there. Before God. Before God. We're not talking here about an archbishop in his glad rags placing a crown on Jesus' head. No, God himself presides over this coronation. He places the crown. What a thing for Jesus at Golgotha of all places to have his eye on this grand, unspeakably grand coronation and enthronement that lies ahead of him. We were on a holiday last year on the Isle of Harris, and the Commonwealth Games were taking place at that time in the Midlands. And I remember having the triathlon on the television in our accommodation. It was the cycling section. And I could kind of look to my left out of the window, and the scene was a tranquil sea loch with a dramatic mountain rising just the other side of that, and it was all very stunning. And then I could look in front of me at the television, and the scene was these cyclists hurtling through all these very built-up, concretey streets in Dudley, no offence to Esther. And it almost seemed then like two worlds here were colliding. But that's nothing, is it, compared to the collision of worlds we're talking about here. Jesus at Golgotha. Golgotha of all places. And he's contemplating this majestic ceremony in the courts of heaven. And that too then is part of the heritage that he anticipates. And then one more component: there's safety, there's intimacy, there's majesty, and there's doxology. There in verse 8, once enthroned before God, Jesus is going to, of all things, sing. We have a singing king here. He's going to sing praises to God's name. So, this then is the heritage which the suffering Jesus anticipates. And remember the other bit of my heading, with urgency. He anticipates this with urgency. He's not just kind of idly pondering it. But he's crying to God for it there in verse 1. Hear my cry, O God. Listen to my prayer. He pleads in verse 2, lead me to the rock that is higher than I. As soon as possible, he said, get me out of here, God. Get me out of this place where I have to be for these hours. As soon as possible, lead me from here. We studied that book, didn't we, a year or two ago with the title, Donald MacLeod, From Glory to Golgotha. Jesus is saying, lead me from Golgotha to glory. There's urgency in verse 7 too. Interesting language in the second half of verse 7. Appoint steadfast love and faithfulness to watch over the king. It's covenant language, steadfast love and faithfulness. Hesed, the Hebrew word that we often comment on, is the one translated steadfast love here. And I think probably, given that we're looking at this through the lens of Jesus, we can see the backdrop of that covenant that we've talked about quite recently when in John's Passion narrative, that covenant that God the Father and God the Son made before the world began, which seems to be in Jesus' mind, doesn't it, in those verses that we read earlier on in John 17. Remember how Jesus there, he's on the brink of the cross, and he says in John 17:4, I glorified you on earth, having accomplished the work that you gave me to do. And now, Father, glorify me in your own presence with the glory I had with you before the world existed. He seems to be here kind of presupposing a covenant agreement, doesn't he? And he said, I've done my bit. I glorified you. Now, Father, it's time for you to do your bit. And I think there's probably something similar going on here then in Psalm 61. He's saying, look, make sure that I get this inheritance, this heritage that's mine. May your covenant love watch over me. You mustn't let Golgotha be this bottomless hole into which I sink and never reemerge. You must make sure. Your covenant love must make sure, because you've committed yourself to this, it must make sure that I do come out of Golgotha and I rise and I ascend and I am enthroned. This is a covenant matter. You're obligated to this. That's the point there in verse 7. And I guess then the application for us at this point this evening, and it's not rocket science, the application for us is that we should rejoice tonight that our Jesus, who at Golgotha were so urgently anticipating his heritage, he now has it. He's taken possession of these things that we've just worked through in this psalm. He is now safe in the shadow of the rock. He is now enjoying intimacy with the one who has pulled him under his wings. He is now experiencing majesty. He's enthroned. And he is now singing. He's now praising God. And we have warrant elsewhere for this application that I'm making. We have warrant from Jesus' own lips. Those striking words, remember, again in John's Gospel, chapter 14, verse 28, he says, "You heard me say to you, I am going away and I will come to you." And he says, "If you loved me, you would have rejoiced because I am going to the Father, for the Father is greater than I." He's saying to these disciples who are shocked that he's talking so much about leaving them, he's saying, if you love me, you'll be happy. You'll rejoice that soon I'm not going to be in these humiliated circumstances anymore. Soon I'm going to be in a completely different setup. And that's where he is tonight. And we love him. We love him more than we love anyone else. And if we love him, then our happiness should be dependent to a significant degree on how he's doing tonight. And this is how he's doing. Psalm 61 is telling us how he's doing tonight. This is where he is. This is what he's experiencing. This is what he's enjoying. Our Savior is in a wonderful situation this evening. And therefore, we who love him can rejoice in that. And just a sub-application relating to that singing. And I've talked about this fairly recently also in connection with John's Gospel. That we perhaps don't contemplate enough, even though it's a big theme in the book of Psalms. The glorified Messiah as a singer. He's a singing king enthroned in heaven. And it doesn't come across here, but it comes across in other psalms, doesn't it? Particularly in Psalm 22 and one or two other places, that we in our singing are really just joining with him. He's the presenter, he's the leader of the singing. When we come together like this on a Sunday and sing, we're singing with Jesus. He's singing praises to God's name, and we're joining with him and singing along with our King. And that's a precious thought too, and gives a certain dignity, surely, to our worship services and to the singing parts of them. So that's the first and the main thing here then. There's a person here who anticipates the heritage with urgency. But then notice with me secondly and briefly, there's a people here who access the heritage through union. There's a people here who access the heritage through union. Because in verse 5 then, it says, "You have given me the heritage." But of course, he carries on, "You have given me the heritage of those who fear your name." And on the surface then, it perhaps appears like he's just saying, this is a heritage that's available to a whole load of folk, and therefore, because I'm one of them, it's available to me. But given the messianic dimension that we've talked about so much, given the way the New Testament approaches things, I think we can say there's more going on here than that. This heritage is available to a whole load of folk. But this is the thing we need to understand. It has been given to Jesus. In the first place, it's his. Most directly, most properly, most naturally, it's his heritage. Others must access it from him, or as the New Testament makes clear, through him. Through being united to him so that they share in everything that's his, including in his heritage. Fearing God's name that's mentioned there in verse 5, that's just another term for faith. And the New Testament teaches us then that faith unites a person to Christ so that everything that is Christ's becomes the believer's also, and Christ's heritage then All the things that he's looking forward to here as he hangs on the cross. Yes, by right, firstly and foremostly, it's his. But because we, through faith, become united to him, it's also ours. Most of you, then, are believers this evening. You're united to Jesus. And that then suddenly opens up a whole other vista here in Psalm 61. You see, perhaps this evening you feel that the words of verses 1 and 2, though yes, as we've seen, particularly applicable to Jesus at Golgotha, perhaps you feel like they're at least a little bit applicable to you tonight. Perhaps your heart is faint. Perhaps you're in a difficult place. The end of the earth. A hard place. You're suffering. You're struggling. You're finding life tough. Well, in that hard place where you are this evening then, you can take Psalm 61 from the lips of Jesus, which is how we've viewed it so far tonight, and you can put it directly onto your own lips because you're united to Jesus. And you can look forward also to this same heritage that he looked forward to in his hard place, that Friday at Golgotha, because you're united to him. And if he was able to look forward to this heritage, then you're able to do so also. It's yours as much now as it is his. And so, tonight, you can cry out to God to bestow on you this heritage that is yours, yours in Christ. You can say, give me that true safety. I feel so vulnerable, so defenseless, so precarious here in this world. Soon, bring me to that true safety where I shall forever be in the shadow of the rock. Bring me to that place of ultimate, consummate intimacy where I shall enjoy the closest possible relationship with the triune God forever and ever. Bring me to reign, to be enthroned with Jesus soon. The New Testament speaks, doesn't it, of us reigning with Jesus throughout that age to come. So even verses 6 and 7 are applicable to us in union with Christ. Bring me to that place where I shall perfectly sing forever the praises to your name. We can look forward in our hard places to this heritage, just like he did in his hard place, because it's ours, because we're united to him. And we can even take at the language of verse 7 about God's steadfast, we can pray for God's steadfast love and faithfulness to watch over us and to make sure we do get there to our heritage. Because God has covenanted this, he's pledged this to us. And so, this evening then, let's first of all put Psalm 61 on Jesus' lips. View him at Calvary, anticipating his heritage. Rejoice that now he's taken possession of it. But let's then also take these words and put them on our own lips as those united to Christ. And let's look forward ourselves to taking possession of the same heritage which Jesus has already taken possession of. What a thing it is, isn't it, to be united to Jesus Christ. And that is our privilege, just through humble faith, faltering faith, poor, patchy, and constant faith. It does this amazing thing. It joins us to Jesus so that we can sing with Charles Wesley, Jesus and all in him is mine. Amen.